This talk was given at the 2011 Winter Datun, a month-long retreat held at the Blazing Mountain Retreat Center in Crestone, Colorado. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. This week, we'll listen to an excerpt from a talk Reggie gave on the practice of meditation. He explains that meditation has become popularized as a tool for stress reduction and basic health. In this teaching, we learn how meditation can become a vehicle of liberation from the confines of ego when practiced as a spiritual discipline.
I'd like to welcome all the week two arrivals, and I wonder if you would stand up so we can see you. And then let's give them a round of applause for actually showing up. Thank you. To come here, to make it over Poncha Pass. See, there are a number of obstacles to actually showing up here. The first one is our ego. And, you know, you guys have been working with that for a long time. And there's always this boundary of should I or shouldn't I? Am I really going to do it? I don't want to do it. I can't do it. I'm going to do it. And then we have this valley, which is very interesting. It's said in the Native American traditions that coming into the valley, you're coming into a different world. It's a sacred world. It's a powerful world. And so just getting over Poncha Pass is a big accomplishment. And for example, today, some people were coming down, they can't because the weather's so unstable and there are all these blizzards hovering around. This is not a natural phenomenon. This is the, you know, the protection in some sense of this place. This place is very protected, and simply to be in this place is to be accepted on some other level. And, you know, the minute you come into town, they're working on you. You know, we could say the awakened mind or the lineage or the spirits of the place. You know, it all comes down to the same thing, different ways of talking about the same thing. So congratulations, you know, on getting over Poncha Pass before the blizzards hit and were closed in. And then the last challenge is actually coming into the mandala. And, you know, everybody has his or her own entry point. And being able to handle your anticipation, your fear, your excitement, your dread, and all of the emotions that happen when we step into the space of the lineage. So I wanted to say a few things about meditation, and then I want to, you know, teach you or guide you in another practice, another bodhicitta practice. In our culture, you know, we hear a lot about meditation now, and meditation is, you know, rightly so. It's put in the service of a lot of values of relaxation, of helping us to sleep at night, helping us to manage our stress levels, you know, the tremendous stress that's part of modern life. And all of that's a good thing. But in this lineage, I think, as you know, meditation is a much more radical and much more fundamentally transformative kind of process. Meditation as a tool or as a resource for our conscious mind and our currently existing life is not a bad thing. But what we're doing is meditation becomes for us a way of entering into a different world. And it's almost as if, to use an analogy from C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, it's almost as if the realm of ego is like a stable. And we are living inside the stable, and we take this stable to be reality. And it's dark, and it's dank, and there's straw on the floor, and there's kind of nasty stuff in the straw, and there are windows, but they're completely covered over with grime, and we can kind of vaguely see outside that there's a world, but we think the world is as dank and as dark and as closed in and unnourishing as the stable itself. And the food that is served in the stable is rancid food. It's rancid vegetables and rancid grains, and we think that's food. And we think that the life in the stable is actually, that's what human life is. And what meditation does is, meditation is a way of presenting ourselves at the door of the stable and calling for help, because we can't, you see, the interesting point is we can't open the door ourselves, because we don't even know where the door is. The door has to be opened from the other side. If there, you know, when we first sit, we don't know if there's another side. We actually think that our little ego world, dank, musty, claustrophobic, we actually have a suspicion that that's all there is. But then we use meditation, we have this sort of vague idea of doing this very radical thing, which is not doing anything to maintain ourselves, at least for maybe 20 minutes a day or whatever we do. We have a vague idea that it might be worth trying that, because nothing else has really worked. And so we do meditate, but we don't know why, really. We don't really exactly know what we're setting ourselves up for. And that is a way of presenting ourselves at the door of the stable, and it's a way of calling for help. Meditation is just calling for help from the outside, because there's no help on the inside. This we have learned from the day of our birth. There's no help on the inside, not real. We meditate, and then at a certain point we begin to sense there's some light. And we see what might be a crack in the door. And meantime, we're just there, we're holding ourselves, we're sitting, we're practicing, we're following our breath, we're being in our body. And then the door starts to slowly, slowly open. And in the beginning, we can only look through. The crack isn't big enough to really step through. But what we see completely shatters us. What we see through that crack is we see the green summer fields waving gently in the wind. And the green that we see, we've never seen anything like that in our lives. And we see trees, tall and majestic. And we see hills. And we see the blue sky that is so deep and so vast. And we feel the breeze coming into our dank little world. And for the first time in our life, we know that this isn't it. This dank stable is not it. And moreover, we feel the longing of our heart to step into that vast, infinite, beautiful outside world. And we know that this dank little ego world was never meant for us. And we, meantime, it's just a little sliver. And, you know, sometimes the sliver closes up and we're back in the ego world, but we can't forget what we've seen. And we know it's real, and we know it's what we were born for. And that is the strange and amazing thing about meditation, that it becomes our way of calling for help. And what we find out is there is help all over the place if we are willing to call for it in the right way. And so we practice and repractice, and the door begins to open again, and then it opens a little wider. And then there are moments of time when we are actually looking out of that door, which it's not quite open enough for us to go out, but the crack becomes so wide that we actually, for moments of time, we forget actually we're in the stable. And we feel that we're out in that world, and we're walking through the luscious, deep green summer grass that's waving in the wind, and we can look up at the sky and lose ourselves in it, and we can feel the majesty of the trees and the soft rolling of the hills, and we feel it in our body. So we practice and we practice and we practice, and then, strangely enough, more and more we find ourselves actually outside the stable. And we find ourselves meeting old friends, but we meet them in a completely different way. And there's a kind of openness and nakedness with them that we always, in some deep dream that we thought might be possible, or at least that we longed for, and then we find that it actually happens. And that's known as the Sangha. So this process of meditation is a process of the deepest kind of change you could ever imagine, because we are leaving behind a world, truly. And we're entering into a different world, a world that is the real one. But then we have a little bit of a problem, which is that we do have a connection with this ego world. We have a connection with this world that we live in here, where everybody sees it as this dank, dark stable. And we feel we need to go back into the stable in order to help the others. You know, we have stepped out and we have experienced our true life and the true world. We felt the freedom and the stunning beauty of the true world. But then we start to remember, you know, that there are thousands and millions and billions of beings who live in the stable and have not discovered the world that they were born for. So what about that? And so our life now, you know, as we move forward, is how do we fulfill our sense of connection and commitment to all those beings who are suffering and not knowing what's possible for them. So as we, you know, think about this, of course, what we realize is that the vessel isn't quite ready, meaning ourselves, that somehow, you know, we don't have the vastness that's needed. We don't have the absolute sort of openness of heart that we need to love others. We feel our limitations. You know, the more we encounter this vast world outside the stable, the more we feel that to go back in the stable, we need to actually grow further. And that is the inspiration behind the bodhicitta practice that we're doing in this dhaton. We are, you know, as I've been saying over the last week, we are interested in unburdening our heart of all of the armor, all of the protection, all of the defenses, all of the fear of being vulnerable. Because we sense, and we're taught in this lineage, that we have the capacity to be a channel for unconditional love for other people. But at this time, the channel is largely closed. And so we need to work on that. And that's what we're doing here. We're trying to, over the course of a month, open ourselves up. And as I've been saying, one thing is to experience our heart as being empty and more unprotected and more a beacon of love for other people. But the second thing is that through doing that practice day in and day out, we're changing our nervous system. We are, you know, there's this saying that neurons that fire together wire together, which in every single neurobiology book I read, that thing is quoted. And what it means is, if we train ourselves in a certain way, you know, doing this compassion practice, we are not simply feeling a different way of being, but we're actually changing the neurological structure of our bodies so that we become more loving people. I mean, I think for many of us, the idea that we could love other people in an unconditional way is very shocking. And it seems impossible. It seems totally implausible. We realize that, you know, we have all these problems and, you know, we weren't loved as small children, and so we become very defensive, and, you know, and we think we have this terrible story of trauma, and then we start to realize actually everybody else has exactly the same story. And we think it's a hopeless situation. Meantime, we do these practices, and as we do the practices, our neurological structure changes. And we change literally the structure of our nervous system so that the experience of tenderness becomes not just a random event or something that happens in an episodic manner, but it actually becomes more who we are. We become more tender people. We become more open people. And we actually begin to discover that we actually deeply love other people. And, you know, we do get activated, we do get triggered, we do shut down, we are aggressive, you know, these things happen. But we start to realize that that actually is just a surface disturbance. And that who we are as people, we discover this through our practice. We start to see that who we are as people is fundamentally loving towards others. That's actually who we are. Well, that's an amazing result of doing the bodhicitta practices, that we start to understand ourselves in a different way. That kind of change is very much like the initial crack in the door of the stable, where we realize this beautiful world that we could live in. Well, the same thing happens with compassion. Initially, we're very closed down people. We're very narcissistic, just looking after ourselves. We're very self-absorbed. You know, this is just how we are, in the modern world particularly. Then, you know, we start doing some bodhicitta practice. Then we start to see that there's, you know, once in a while, we feel something very different inside. But then that crack widens and we start to realize that's actually who we are. And that becomes a very deep inspiration for us to continue with the practice, to widen that field of compassion in ourselves so that over time it becomes who we are. So in the same way that Trungpa Rinpoche said to us in the very beginning when we, you know, his students in the very early 70s, we had a very negative view of our spiritual capacity. And he said, you know, you need to drop it because you can live in the sacred world. You can awaken to this beautiful world around us. And we saw him enjoying that world. We saw him in touch with it. My friend John Baker, who was one of our early, you know, this little ragtag band of students in the very early days, told me that one time Rinpoche was in Chicago, and they were in somebody's apartment, and it was, I don't know, somewhere in the south side of Chicago, and it was a dump. I mean, basically, it was tenement, you know, housing. And Rinpoche was sitting on the back porch, and there was this huge sign completely hiding the sky with somebody with a can of beer that he was holding up. And Rinpoche looked at that poster of this beer and this, you know, this like totally tacky, you know, advertisement for a long time. And John was thinking, what the, you know, what is he doing? And at a certain point, he turned to John and he said, isn't this world so beautiful? And what John realized is that Rinpoche lived in a different world from the one he lived in. That the world was that beautiful. And that's the world that Rinpoche was inviting us into. He said to us, you know, not only do you have the capacity to do it, once this lineage gets into your system, you're going to have to do it. Because once you know that's possible, it will haunt you until the day you die. And so it is with us here. We have seen enough to know that that world is real, and that will haunt us till the day we die. And in a sense, you know, we're in big trouble. It's almost you wish, almost you didn't know. You wish that on certain days that you'd never seen it. Because life would have been so much easier if we'd never seen that there's a sacred world outside of our little version. We could have just gone to work and tried to make money and taken our vacations and, you know, I've got 2 weeks off. Damn, I've got to go to a program. Or, you know, damn, I've got to go on retreat. You know, I wanted to go to Hawaii. I wanted to go to Belize. I do not want to go on retreat. I do not want to go and sit on my butt in a cabin for 3 weeks when I could have been on vacation. So it's just very painful. We're haunted. We know it's there, and eventually we give in. We go on retreat, and the experience that we have is so much better than being in Hawaii. You know, whatever it was we were looking for on vacation, we find it 20 times over in retreat. But the problem is, it's the getting there, and it's the pain of giving up Hawaii. Well, it's very much the same with the compassion practice. You know, once we see that there is within us a tremendous depth of care for other people, that there's a tremendous sense of connection with those who suffer, and there's a feeling of obligation that's not a moral obligation, it's almost a somatic obligation, that the people in this world, you know, we taste the possibilities of freedom and joy, and that because of that, we have, the people who suffer have a claim on us. And we realize that there is within us, you know, far beneath the ego concerns for convenience and ease, there is a much deeper wellspring in us of love that will do anything to relieve the suffering of another person. Then that's a shocking discovery. We never thought that about ourselves. We've always thought of ourselves, you know, in such a low way. We never thought that we actually within us have this deep wellspring that yearns to help people. There's a story told in the Mahayana, or there's a teaching on, about the Bodhisattva path, that when the Bodhisattva sees a person who is actually okay, his or her heart sinks a little bit. Because there is this deep need to meet suffering and to relieve it. On the other hand, if the Bodhisattva has his or her last piece of food and a starving person comes toward them, they feel a deep sense of joy because they can offer something to relieve suffering. And, you know, you read those stories and you think, well, that's not me. But the thing is, through doing the practices and deepening our sense of connection with our own hearts, the shocking thing is we find out, actually, that is me. Ultimately, that is who I am. So we are, we're taken over by this lineage. And, you know, in the beginning, we feel like we're slightly in control. And Caroline and I were talking about this just before I came in. At a certain point, you realize how you are so not in control. And in our case, you know, I mean, our biggest challenge getting up in the morning is just staying with the journey and staying with the lineage and what it's doing. That's the biggest challenge, staying with the program. And so it becomes for all of us. You know, we have this, in the beginning, we think our life belongs to us, right? Isn't it true? This is my life. I've got to get my own life straightened out. You know, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. But when you step outside that stable, you realize that it is so not your life. And not even one iota is your own life. Your life is life with a capital L, flowing through you. And your biggest problem is staying with the immensity of your life and with the magic that is washing all over you. That's your biggest problem. How are you going to stay with that? And if we, you know, that's why we meditate, frankly. It's why I meditate, because if I don't meditate, I can't stay with the program. And I do want to stay with the program. I want to stay with this program. This is a good program. I like this program. And I'm not talking about this program. I'm talking about that program. I'm talking about the big program, the cosmic program. In a way, it's a huge relief for us. Wow. You know, all I've got to do is just show up. And the rest of it is not my problem. It's a huge relief. But then you realize that showing up is not that easy. Like I was saying in the beginning, congratulations for showing up. Because that's what it's all about. And meditation gives us the tools to show up. It helps us show up. And if we don't, you know, if we don't keep, you know, acknowledging we have a lot of really hard work to do to show up, pretty soon we're going to find that we haven't been showing up in a long time. And then when you don't show up, you're not with the program. And when you're not with the program, you're back in that dirty, dank, smelly little stable. Which you might say, well, you know, okay, fine, didn't work out. But the problem with that, the post-meditation, dank, dirty little stable, is that you actually know that there's another world. And then here we are, haunted again by the lineage. So I want to thank all of you for allowing yourselves to be haunted by the lineage. And I want to thank you for your desperation in coming here. That you got so desperate, you were so desperately haunted by the lineage or by life with a capital L that you showed up here. Because you have to be really desperate to come here. You do. And because, you know, it's hard work. It's hard work. So, good job.
To download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.